Hello, and welcome to Misspoken, a Lady Live Lit show featuring performers who are writers and comedians, actors and bloggers, exploring a new theme each month. This is Rosamund Lannan, and I host the show with Jasmine Davila. The following is a recording of our October 31st, 2018 show at the Gallery Cabaret. This month's theme was Suffragette City, featuring Hope Rehack, Chloe Riley, Leah Jones, Samantha Abernethy, and special guest co-host Ines Bellina. Tune in for our next show, recorded on November 3rd at the U.S. Pizza Museum. The theme is Pizza Storytelling Showdown, and it's not so much a theme as a battle of the slices. That's a battle of the slices. For more information, you can find us at miss-spoken.com.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Well, happy Halloween, everybody. So hello and welcome to Misspoken, a Lady Live Lit show featuring personal essays by female-identifying and non-binary writers. We are your hosts, Jasmine Davila and Ines Bellina.
So you can usually find Misspoken here at the Gallery Cabaret on the last Wednesday of the month. And with every show, we take on a new and exciting theme. And today's theme is
Suffragette City!
Woo! Yeah. So we are just going to get started because there's so much to cover when it comes to suffragetting. So our first reader is Hope Rehack, who was born and raised in Chicago and was shaped by its public schools. She attended Oberlin College on a scholarship from the Pose Foundation and holds an Posse. Yeah. Oh, cool. Okay. From the Posse Foundation and holds an MFA in writing for the screen and stage from Northwestern University. She's lived in Copenhagen, Ohio, New York, D.C., and Los Angeles, but loves being back at home. So give it up for Hope.
Thanks. Hi. Hi. I'm just clarifying. We are taping this for a podcast, right? Because I told my mom that. Okay. So you can hear me, right? You can hear everything. Okay, great. Okay, cool. I'm going to read. Hello, thanks for coming. It's very cool that you're here. It's very cool I'm first because people are paying the most attention. And you're not drunk yet, which is, you know, a different kind of benefit. I'll just start. I won $100 last month by betting my father that Brett Kavanaugh would be confirmed to the Supreme Court. I accepted his bet the week that Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's accusations became public, which, if you can remember that far back, was actually the week before she actually testified in front of the Judiciary Committee on National Television. "You really think he'll still be confirmed after her testimony?" my dad asked a few days later, incredulously wondering if I wanted to pull out of the bet, knowing full well I didn't have a spare $100 to pay him should I have lost. I was confident. I had also predicted Trump's win 2 years ago through the sheer power of anxiety. The sole benefit to me of my anxiety disorder is being constantly painfully right about everything right now. My cynical brain has never made so many correct guesses before. 2018's been a really good year for me getting things right. I don't own a TV, so I watched part of the hearings at my parents' house. My father was distraught. Although he's progressive, he expressed secondhand humiliation for Kavanaugh. "The man's been mortified in front of his wife and children," he pointed out. "I can't imagine anything worse." I was shocked. My dad is unequivocally an avowed feminist. He and my mother raised us with radical values, and my dad has spent nearly three decades teaching teenagers of all genders at a magnet school on the Near West Side. He is, to be honest, often more woke than me. This isn't part of the essay, but I'm going to sidebar because I think I have time. He does this thing that he's been doing for almost 30 years called the slang dictionary, where he has his students compile illustrated definitions of slang words that they use at school. So literally he is the one who tells me about what bae means. But this moment of his empathy to Kavanaugh made my mother and me angry. Dr. Ford had already testified that day. She had been embarrassed repeatedly by senators and the media throughout her ordeal of coming forward. "Dad," I started, "being a woman is literally constant humiliation. It's not the worst thing." "For a man, it is," my dad insisted. We had reached an impasse, and I kept thinking of the apocryphal Margaret Atwood quote, "Men are afraid women will laugh at them. Women are afraid men will kill them." I realized as a woman, I personally have become inured to being mortified. Maybe this started when I was teased about my body or skin in high school. Maybe it started when I began writing and performing comedy. Sorry, this isn't. maybe it's, I'm very good at it though, just trust. Maybe it started even before that. My sense of humor has always skewed towards self-deprecation, and as the comedian Hannah Gadsby said in her recent special Nanette, yeah, which you can watch on Netflix, okay. As she said, do you understand what self-deprecating means when it comes to somebody who already exists in the margins? It's not humility, it's humiliation. It's impossible to remember a time when regular ritualistic mortification was not a regular part of my daily life. Keeping our female egos under assault is one of the primary tools by which capitalist white supremacist patriarchy controls us, and that's been obvious to me for as long as I can remember. Dr. George Yancey. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone can testify. It's fine. It's an interactive thing. Dr. George Yancey, the professor of philosophy at Emory University, who last week penned an op-ed in the New York Times that was entitled #IAmSexist, touched on this in his piece. He doesn't use the language of embarrassment or humiliation. In fact, he never uses those words, but he touches on it when he describes a game he played called Catch a Girl, Get a Girl that he and his friends would play as adolescents. In his words, we would count to give the girls a head start. We would then run after them. If you caught a girl, you could steal a kiss. Some of the boys attempted to grope the girls. End quote. For the boys, this was fun. For the girls, it was ritualistic humiliation, a form of social policing that underscores and strengthens the power dynamic of what French feminist scholar, what is it called, Taylor? How do I say it? Irigaray, Luce Irigaray. I know how to spell it, but I don't know how to say it. That's what she, but anyway, she called it a dominant phallic economy. Again, I'm gonna read that one more time. For the girls, it was ritualistic humiliation, a form of social policing that underscores and strengthens the power dynamic of what French scholar Luce Irigaray named a dominant phallic economy. Is this too heady? Let's talk about movies. That's fine, we can do that. I'm too much of a stand-up. I can't. Okay. Hi. About a month ago, on the very Saturday Brett Kavanaugh was finally confirmed to the Supreme Court by a ruling minority of an old white male-dominated Congress, I chose to go on a date with a cisgendered man. I know, it's absurd. It was our third date and we planned to get Indian food. And then see a movie called Mandy at the Music Box, a new Nick Cage film I hadn't heard much about except that it was campy horror. Are you sure? My date asked in advance, knowing enough about my taste to warrant a little skepticism at my eagerness. Yeah, I explained, I want to see what all the fuss is about. Mostly, I wanted to get my mind off politics. My obsessive anxiety, while medicated since Trump's election, was getting out of control, and a movie felt like it might be a good distraction. I can feel my sister telling me to slow down, so I will. Thank you. Now you might be thinking, why? Why go on a date with a human male in 2018? And you would be right to ask, because in all honesty, the rest of us should all be boycotting them. But I do like men. I know a few good ones. As I mentioned, I have a good relationship with my dad and my brother, and I have too many platonic guy friends for someone in her late 20s. Oh, the man I went on dates with was and is a good guy. Also, he came from a Mexican-American family in Texas, and as he and I discussed, they're suffering as much or more under Trump's fascist regime. I'm going to say it one more time. They're suffering as much or more under Trump's fascist regime as a white lady like me who just wants to be paid equally and have control over my own body. Oh, anyway, I was so angry that day that, in all honesty, had my date been with a white dude, I would have canceled. Is that problematic? I don't care. It's true, there's a difference between being problematic and being rude. Someone else usually needs to confirm you're being problematic. I know and own when I'm being rude. Frankly, I think women right now especially can stand to be a lot more rude. Do you know the linguistic and historical difference between a suffragist and a suffragette? Anyone? Cool, that's what I expected, thank you. The suffragists were peaceful. The suffragettes favored direct action. Which word do we use, you know? When the British suffragettes were fighting for the vote, they were rude to the point of self-immolation. How rude it was for suffragette Emily Davison to run onto the grounds of the 1913 Epsom Derby, waving her women's social and political union flag, getting hit by the king's horse, and dying for her cause. How rude. Between the white men at work, in my friend group, and in my family, I have the exact number of white men in my life right now that I can handle. Again, a lot of them. I like them. They're cool. But electing to bring a new one voluntarily into my life and to have to explain to him how he's part of a ruling minority that sit atop of a power structure that oppresses everyone else in spite of his intentions is just not my idea of a great time right now. Anyway, this guy and I went to the Music Box and we saw Mandy. Has anyone else here seen it? Damn. All right, well, it's okay. The first hour is a disturbing little acid trip of a movie, but at the start of the second act, Nick Cage's wife, Mandy, gets kidnapped by a patriarchal sex cult. You can almost see where this is going, right? The enigmatic leader, a kind of Charlie Manson type, has his handmaids drug Mandy by force, and then while she's tripping, he comes to her naked and demands sex. Mandy, who's as high as a kite against her own wishes, starts laughing hysterically at his naked body. For a moment, I was transfixed. Mandy's laughter starts sincerely, the giggling of the inebriated, but when she sees the dominating man getting agitated, she laughs harder, meaner, recognizing her laughter as her last weapon against her fate. The movie plays her laughter on a chilling loop until we realize that this is not going to end in her triumph. I heard the music and saw the framing and remembered that this was a movie written and directed by a man, and I bolted to the restroom to wait out the violence I knew was coming. We're almost done. Now I heard what happened next secondhand, because my suspicions were correct, and I was, again, hiding in the bathroom to avoid watching it. But apparently Mandy is burned alive for refusing sex with the cult leader on screen. Graphically, in front of her husband, Nick Cage, which is meant to be the inciting incident for the rest of the film, which quickly becomes a revenge porn. Shocking, I know. When I returned to the theater, Mandy's skull was smoldering in a pile of ashes, and Nick Cage was, naturally, screaming at the empty woods. Men are afraid women will laugh at them. Women are afraid men will kill them. It was almost too literal. It was certainly too much for me on the same day as an accused sex offender was appointed to the highest judiciary in the country of my birth by a White House and a Congress also chock full of sex offenders. The Atwood quote rang again and again in my ears. I am sick of dating men in part because I can no longer digest opinions on things that don't matter, like the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. Or who the fuck brews the hoppiest craft beer? For the record, I have a master's degree in film and theater. I care a lot about film and theater. I'm just over male-authored art. That's the fault of Mandy. I hit my limit. And it happened. And it's hard to date men when you are no longer able to respect their artistic point of view. The dude I went on the date with understood my frustrations, heard me out, and we went on one more date before I decided I could not in good conscience continue dating him. I am, you see, too angry. I am too rude. Now would be a good time to talk about one last film and television related thing, which is Lysistrata, the Aristophanes play from 411 BCE. You might be familiar with it, especially since Spike Lee's Chirac adapted the story for our city and our time very recently. In the 2400-year-old play, a group of Greek women decides that in order to end the Peloponnesian War, they'll withhold sex from their husbands until a treaty for peace has been signed. I don't know if Aristophanes meant to persuade women to boycott sex with men through this play, which is a comedy in which, spoiler alert, peace is achieved by the sex strike. But consider me persuaded.
Next up, we have Chloe Riley. Chloe Riley is a journalist, theater critic, poet, and skeptic, depending on the day. She's written for The Guardian, The Chicago Reader, and The Huffington Post, as well as some New York theater magazines that could have paid better. She frequently writes about the feeling of being a woman and a human being and the contradictions therein. And there are so many contradictions. Chloe?
Hi, how y'all doing? Gonna read something for you. Okay, so I'm standing up here dressed as Claire freaking Underwood from House of Cards, a monster in her own right who ultimately became the first pretend female president at a time when many people in this country had hopes about what that would look like in real life. That's my husband, Francis, in the audience. He's dead, so that's where we're at. But let us turn to more important matters, like, I don't know, the history of women trying to obtain the right to vote in this godforsaken country. On November 5th, 1872, long time ago, the New York Times ran a small paragraph under the heading Minor Topics. That's minor as in insignificant, not like the guys who dig for coal or women, but everybody can do coal. Miss Susan B. Anthony, it starts, has had the honor of leading to the polls the advance guard of the coming squadrons of female voters. We have heard before of solitary instances of the recognition of the female franchise, but this picket guard of nine is a tangible enough force to make people reflect on the future possibilities which it involves. This very short story was referencing the arrest of Anthony and a handful of other women who illegally voted in the presidential election that year, some 50 years before the 19th Amendment would legally grant women in the United States the right to vote. Anthony had persuaded election inspectors to register her and the other women, a move which resulted in her arrest and a trial in which Anthony was ultimately found guilty. In an op-ed published just one decade later, the New York Times was just a little more outspoken in its feelings about women voting. Literal people may ask, why then does not woman have the right of suffrage? The answer is easy. She does not want it. Of course, it must be admitted that women, or some women, may think they want the ballot, but they do not really want it. Oh, it gets worse. Philosophers have observed, general philosophers have observed that the female desire is invariably kindled by that which is, or seems to be, unobtainable. Ooh, really just digging yourself into a solid hole there, 1882 New York Times. That delightful article also references happy homes and the seeming destruction that would bore down upon them should women obtain the right to even be like remotely equal citizens of this country. It's these happy homes which still seem to be bothered by the idea of women moving ahead, which begs the question, what exactly is a happy home in the age of feminism today? Not long ago, I was indulging in the very pleasant pastime of throwing back Miller High Lifes with three of my closest female friends, women who I admire on so many different levels: professional drive, generosity, kindness to others around them, striving to stay informed, educated, pushing towards feminist ideals, etc. Love of Miller High Life, obviously, ranking high on the list as well. And after a few brews, it started to occur to me that much of the conversation had turned to venting about their cis male partners' inability to take charge of basically any domestic duties whatsoever. Shopping for the food, cooking the food, washing the dishes, etc. A lot of this seemed to revolve around food, actually. And I thought, how are we still in this place? Like, I certainly watched my mom and dad act out these stupid roles, and I know my dad's parents acted out the same stupid roles before them. Dad works, better paying job. Mom works, gets paid less, and is sort of expected to do more of the housekeeping and cooking because of it. But it was disturbing to realize that my friends now had the same experiences. Parents who fell into those same patterns, and now, even though they had loving, well-intentioned partners, the curse of the happy home and all the obnoxious, mundane work that comes with it had been passed down to my friends as well. In a note of hope, in one of John Lennon's final interviews before he was killed, he and Yoko Ono spoke with Playboy about how she and John had separated for 18 months after she basically kicked him out. She couldn't handle that women to him were basically people who were serving him. And she was an artist herself, and she said she wasn't going to be castrated, looked down upon, because she wasn't John Lennon, wasn't the Beatles. Here's John during the interview talking about both food and home. And I'm going to try to do my best John Lennon here, so apologies in advance. I've been baking bread and looking after the baby because, you know, bread and babies, as every housewife knows, is a full-time job. After I made the loaves, I felt like I had conquered something. But as I watched the bread being eaten, I thought, well, Jesus, don't I get a gold record, a knighted, or nothing? Although there's this thing called the women's movement, society just took a laxative and they've just fought it. They haven't really had a good shit yet. The seed was planted sometime in the late 60s, right? But the real changes are coming, man. I'm the one who's come a long way. I was the pig, and it is a relief not to be a pig. The pressures of being a pig were enormous. I don't have any hankering to be looked upon as a sex object, a male macho rock and roll singer. I got over that a long time ago. I'm not even interested in projecting that. So I like it to be known that, yes, I looked after the baby and I made bread and I was a house husband and I'm proud of it. It's the wave of the future and I'm glad to be on the forefront of that too. Woof. Pretty revolutionary stuff there, John and Yoko. And pretty bad English accent, Chloe. And so what happened? This interview was in 1980. Where's the wave of the future? When are the real changes coming? If Susan B. Anthony was fighting for the right to vote, the modern day female identifying human is fighting for the right to escape the grip of the happy home. I don't have the answers to this. It requires a lot, both in terms of energy and enthusiasm, something I feel we're all running really short on right now. At least one thing it definitely requires is for cis men and women, as well as female and male identifying humans, to communicate and come together in ways that I know are really difficult right now. There's so much polarization, so many feelings of otherness, but a home, even a remotely happy one, requires at least an attempt at a solid foundation. So I leave you with this hopeful quote from Jess Zimmerman's essay, Hunger Makes Me, which many of you in this room may be familiar with, and if you're not, you should do yourself a favor and read it. She talks about the idea of both physical hunger and emotional hunger, of not being satisfied because she never thought she had the right to ask for the deeply rooted things she needed most. She writes, attentiveness, consideration, compliments, small and large kindnesses, feeling truly loved, having someone put you first while you put them first because you're in cahoots to make each other's lives easier and better. Most people do like that when it's thoughtful and sincere. It's here, more than in the big gestures, that romance lives, in being actively caring and thoughtful in a way that is reciprocal but not transactional. So let us all, male identifying and female identifying humans alike, start with the small step of making each other's lives easier. And in doing so, build brick by brick a new idea of a home, both happy and equal. I'm Claire Underwood and I approve this message.
Claire Underwood, 2020. I am here for it. Yeah, even better. So, moving right along, Jasmine Davila has appeared in venues both small and medium-sized, reading in live lit shows such as Essay Fiesta, The Skewer, and Tuesday Funk. You can find her on Instagram and Twitter as @Jasmine.
Thank you. All right, here we go. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was a wet, gray Thursday in December. I brought neither guest nor witness, which was fine because I didn't want to make a fuss. We had no flowers, neither ribbons nor rice, not even music, but I didn't care. I remember that I wore a black sweater and skirt, my hair was down, and I had pearl studs in my ears. I don't remember what lipstick I wore that day, but I know it must have been flawless. I wanted to look my best when I stood up in a federal courthouse and recited the following words. I hereby declare, on oath, that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen. That I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by the law, that I will perform non-combatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by the law, that I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by the law, and that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, so help me God. It has been nearly 10 years since America made an honest woman out of me, a simple country girl from the Pearl of the Orient, otherwise known as the Philippines. I became a citizen in the last days of the administration of Bush the Younger. I was safe, secure in the knowledge that my first full-term president would, in fact, be the skinny kid with the big ears and the funny name, Barack Obama. I count as my pre-naturalization bachelorette party the Obama-Biden campaign victory party in Grant Park. It was perfect. Thousands of people carrying their personal items in clear plastic bags and unwilling to use the restroom lest they lose their spot near the stage. Somebody in the crowd shared the Domino's pizza they were able to get through the security checkpoints. We kept our eyes up on the big screens that playing CNN, watching computer animated maps of the United States as Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana, of all places, went blue. We all burst into tears when, almost at the stroke of 10 o'clock, Obama was declared the winner of the 2008 presidential election. Becoming a citizen right after that felt like I was emigrating all over again. Now, I had been in America, a permanent resident alien with a green card, for years, but becoming a citizen was like unlocking the super secret, sexy, extra crispy levels of a video game that I'd only previously played in a very limited capacity. Now, America and I had been living together for years before we got hitched. It wasn't easy, especially in the beginning, but being little at the time, I at least had my parents to shield me from the less pleasant aspects of being a new immigrant in a tiny apartment in Queens, New York. I was like Prince Akeeman coming to America, who said, "Fascinating, Semi, look at this. America is great indeed. Imagine a country so free you can throw glass on the street." But even after all that time, I still expected to feel different once I was carried across the threshold and laid ever so gently at the feet of the Statue of Liberty. Being American, it was going to be different, right? It had to be. But was it going to be better? I guess. I still don't know. I mean, it's 2018. It's 10 years after I willingly got myself tagged into the Great American Experiment, and I am still here. I'm sorry because I didn't know. I haven't done any kind of a job explaining what citizenship, what being an American means to me. What, if anything, do I do now that I am an American that I couldn't do 10 years ago? Well, I vote. That's the first fucking thing. I registered to vote like right after I became a citizen, which was great, except that like for some reason the forms didn't get turned in, so I had to register all over again, but whatever, that's fine. I saw Hamilton twice, both times with our fellow reader Leah, and whenever Lafayette would sing "Immigrants" in Yorktown, the world turned upside down before he and Hamilton would exult together, "We get the job done." I had to stop myself from leaping out of my chair and screaming, "Yeah, boy," like I was Flavor Flav or something. I am unapologetically loud and brash when I chant USA, USA, USA when I watch the Olympics. And I am glad to have a country to cheer for during the Olympics because, well, the Philippines may be many things, competitive in sport at a global level is not one of them. I get fearful and insecure when I read about someone in the current administration threatening to revoke the citizenship of naturalized citizens. I flinch when I am reminded every goddamn day that to be an American woman, to be an American of color, can be, and often is, a rough fucking deal. Whenever I read about immigrants enlisted in the US military getting killed overseas, I get really upset. And I think to myself, you were so close. We were so close. Because that process is how my father earned his citizenship. It's how many Americans do it, risking their lives so they can spend a little less time waiting to be made whole. Now, every week on Sunday nights, I sit in my favorite chair. Actually, it is my only chair because I live in a little studio in Andersonville. Turn on my television set and make sure it's set to TLC. When TLC isn't airing television programs about pristine white families with multiple births or patients of a popular if surly weight loss doctor in Houston, Texas, they broadcast the greatest show on earth, which is 90 Day Fiancé. If you're not aware, let me say again, 90 Day Fiancé is the greatest television show on earth. Each season features several couples, each comprised of a sad sack American and the international romantic partner they met on the internet or while they were on vacation. It's called 90 Day Fiancé because there is such a thing as a K-1 visa, where the international romantic partner, once approved for it, can travel to the States where, upon arrival, they have 90 days to marry their sad sack American and be able to stay, and then so be able to stay in the United States for good. So there's never a question to these couples that they should settle in the United States. We never see discussions about whether or not they should instead make a home in Spain or Jamaica or Moldova. America is the unassailable bastion of freedom and democracy and also capitalism and commerce. Seriously, there was this guy Pedro who tried to send his mother and sister in the Dominican Republic a flat screen TV that he bought at Best Buy only to be foiled at the UPS store when the quoted shipping charge was something like $900. But if you watch the show, you would know all about Pedro already and understand that him pulling a stunt like this should come as no surprise as he is an actual dummy. Anyway, he wasn't an American yet, but he was definitely married to one. He was already living in America, where he has already discovered that while the streets are not entirely paved with gold, they're not entirely full of broken glass either. Thank you.
And now I'm going to introduce Samantha Abernathy, who is a freelance writer and editor who has previously worked for Retired Black Chicagoist and Obama's political nonprofit Organizing for Action. She lives in Logan Square with her husband, her greyhound, and more books than she'll ever read. Yay!
Hi. Well, I guess I'll start by telling you what I'm wearing. I bought this flannel onesie as a getting ready outfit for my wedding, and I got my bridesmaids matching ones because that's what you do. I had my wedding in rural Western Pennsylvania in October of 2016. So in addition to my nuptials, all of my dear Chicago friends were treated to a tour of the pro-Trump crazy signs of rural Pennsylvania. It was great. It was just a total bonus, and I think it really helped us all prepare for what was to come. But most importantly, this onesie's super cozy, and we could all use a little extra comfort, so I'm wearing it. I didn't even know it was Halloween. So a few weeks after that wedding, it was Election Day, and I was seeking all forms of comfort in any way possible, so I put on this onesie and I poured myself a bourbon as I watched the news, because I had just spent a very long day working as an election judge at my polling place. That means that I had spent about 15 hours sitting in a metal folding chair in the men's locker room at the Holstein Park Fieldhouse up the street. I've been an election judge 3 times now. While it sounds very official, it's really not. In order to become a judge, you submit an application. They prefer you would complete a training, but it's not even necessary. You just show up. So everybody makes the cut. And I know no one's looking at your resume because I have been appointed 3 times as a Republican judge of election. Each polling place is supposed to have 2 Democratic and 2 Republican judges. And I guess there's a shortage of Republicans because I get appointed as a Republican every time. Positions paid, current rates $150 for the day, plus an additional $50 if you actually complete the training. So it's not a volunteer thing, but it is a very long and unpredictable day, and you kind of need a certain amount of dedication to do it. Don't really recommend it, but it's it's important that somebody is there to make sure that the ballots get counted and are held accountable. So first, you arrive at your polling place no later than 5 a.m. Then you set up all of the equipment that's been delivered in this big metal locker. There are a lot of complicated instructions, and everything has to be in place by 6 a.m. when the polls open. If the polling place doesn't open on time, it has to stay open late. And you can't leave until well after the polls are closed, so you want to open on time. And that's the hardest thing about being an election judge, is you can't leave the polling place. You are there all day. And you're really stuck if something happens, like the ballot counter doesn't work very well. So some of the aldermen's offices will like come by and deliver lunch, but I always show up with about 3 days worth of food and a gallon of coffee. So I'm gonna tell you a little bit about voting and the voting machines and what your ballot's gonna look like, just so we're all totally prepared here, okay? If you cast your vote early, you'll likely vote on a machine. First thing you should know is that you shouldn't lean on those because those table legs are a little rickety and it's very top heavy and the whole thing falls over way too easily. It's just good to know. The election judge will hand you a plastic card, and that contains your ballot. You put it into the machine, and it shows everything. It's pretty intuitive if you are of an age that is comfortable using a touchscreen digitally. Not a lot of people who vote are, because as you may have heard, old people vote. more than young people. You're able to review your ballot before you submit, and it's all there. It's pretty clear. But on election day, most election judges prefer to hand out paper ballots. Because there are so many more polling stations on election day, each one only has one machine. And that machine is often sort of reserved because it is necessary for people who need translation and who need special accommodations for disabilities. So it is generally not used. You're usually going to get a paper ballot. So if this information makes you want to cast your ballot early, the city offers 51 locations for early voting, one in each ward plus a supersite downtown, and any Chicago resident can vote in any voting location. You can always request to use the machine on election day, but they're not going to offer it to you outright, most likely. So let's talk about the paper ballots. Okay, paper ballots are weird because it's a multiple choice test, right? So you'd think it'd be like circle your answer or fill in a dot next to your choice. But no, there's this broken arrow. Yeah. You connect it with a line. So it's a multiple choice test, but the answer is like art. And it's very confusing. A lot of people get it wrong. And also the way it's lined up on the ballot, it's very hard. If you have any issues with, it's not intuitive at all. And a lot of people get it wrong, and there are a lot of errors. So once you complete your art project, and don't forget, you have to use the special pen that they give you. It's like a fine tip marker. If you don't, it doesn't work at all. Yeah. So once you've completed your paper ballot, an election judge will show you how to feed it into the ballot reader. If your ballot's completed correctly, the machine will just eat it. But if you've made a mistake, such as voting twice for the same office or not voting for a particular office, the machine will spit it back out and ask if you're okay with this, and you have a chance to review your ballot. In 2016, the ballot reader at my precinct broke. So for most of the day, we had to instruct voters to put their paper ballots into this locked metal box, which sketched people out, and they were kind of right. We were able to get a tech in to fix it before the polls closed, just before, and then we had to stay late to scan every ballot. And this meant that if there was an error that spit it back out, it didn't matter, we just had to feed it back in. There was no opportunity for the voter to complete it, to fix their mistakes. So your error becomes your vote. That's another reason where I would lean towards the digital machines, even if they can be hacked. Let's just pretend they can't be hacked because I can't handle that. Not to mention the other mistakes we would have made that night, because we were stuck in our polling place until 11 p.m. on election night 2016. So I get out of there. I've been in a box all day. I come home and I'm like, so let's turn on the TV. And my husband's like, it's over. It's done. Do you want some bourbon? I'm like, you're just being a pessimist. And I was like, oh, damn. So, if this makes you want to cast your ballot early, the city offers 51 locations for early voting. All locations will be open every day, including Sunday, from now until Election Day. One of the excuses people use for not voting is time. They don't have time. Well, yeah. Here's the thing. It doesn't really take that long. And the biggest time issue is the line. Of course, a majority of voters cast their ballots before or after work, because Election Day isn't a holiday, and it really should be. So we have a line. I have a special place in my heart for the people who show up at 5:59 a.m. ready to exercise their vote. I love them so much. But the reality of the situation is most people show up at 6 p.m. after work, and the polls close at 7. And just so you know, if you are in line when polls close, it has to remain open until you cast your ballot. They cannot close until you vote, even if it's supposed to close. If you're in line, it stays open. Okay. During the March primaries, I helped an elderly woman fill out her ballot. She didn't ask for help at first. She tried to do it on her own, but her hand shook and she had trouble with the arrow, had trouble making the straight line. And she spent a lot of time putting her ballot together, and then we went to scan it and the machine spit it back out. And I looked at it and realized that she maybe needed help. And I sat down and we went through and we did it again. She was there for almost 2 hours just to make sure that her voice was heard. And that's what I think about when someone starts tapping their toes and acting inconvenienced at 6:30 p.m. Only about 300 people vote in person on election day at my precinct. There are about 900 voters in a precinct. But more than 700 people voted. That means more than half of the people in this particular neighborhood vote early. That means voting early is not the exception, it's becoming the rule And it's a lot easier because the people who show up at 6:30 on election day, they might not have remembered there was an election until like 5:30. Truth is, us engaged, active voters, our votes count just as much as theirs. And they might not even vote if we're in line in front of them. So it's kind of helpful if you get out of their way because they didn't even think to vote. Anyway, there's one thing political organizers have been really hammering home the last few months is asking people if they have a plan to vote. What is your plan for getting to the polls? How are you getting there? And then what are you voting for? It's more important to make sure that they have a plan because, I don't know, I was planning on voting this weekend and now it turns out my parents are coming to town. I don't know when it's going to happen. I might actually wind up voting on election day, which I haven't done in a while. But now I kind of want to, but no, I'm not going to. I'm going to vote early. The thing is, if you know someone who hasn't committed to voting, help them make a plan and figure out where to vote and how to vote. And just remember that the people who don't remember until the last minute to vote, their vote counts just as much as yours. But, you know, yours can be better in its own way. So if this makes you want to cast your ballot early, the city offers 51 locations for early voting, including a super site downtown. The nearest location is the Bucktown Library at Milwaukee and Waubonsia.
Thanks. All right. Our last reader of the evening is Leah Jones. Leah Jones is the founder of Natif Facilitation, where she plans and leads retreats for all sizes of teams. She spends her free time paralyzed in fear about the hellscape of 2018 or trying to turn fear into laughs at stand-up open mics around the city. You can follow her on Twitter for health policy tweets and photos of her cats Spidey and Cowboy. You really should. They're adorable. Her handle is Chicago Leah. Leah, come on up.
You don't get it? Stand-up open mics? Music stands. It's the best. All right. I'm not wearing it tonight, but for my Halloween costume this year, I dress like a person trapped in an escalator, which had nothing to do with tonight's topic and everything to do with the party I went to on Saturday night. Thank you, Huff and Coopers. The costume prompt was phobias, and I went as a person trapped in an escalator, which is a very legitimate fear. The funny thing about this costume is that everybody at the party had a story to tell. Everybody had some sort of, like, I knew a guy's story about an escalator injury. It turns out that my fear, which I think is kind of silly, is way more warranted than I thought. Isn't that the case, though? You start talking about something, and then everybody has a story. On my 40th birthday, two things happened. Paul Ryan made his first run at dismantling the Affordable Care Act, and I found out that I needed some sort of surgery to manage uterine fibroids. When I started talking about my fibroids, I found out that, like, everyone I knew had a fibroid story. Women who had been laid low for vague surgeries now admitted it had been for a myomectomy or an endometrial ablation, which is like sandblasting the inside of your uterus. Maybe you didn't know that. Friends and strangers began openly talking to me about racing against their own body. Could I finish a meeting and get to the bathroom before I bleed through a tampon, a backup pad, and my jeans? If I go to the bathroom on my way out of the office, can I make it to the Mariano's by the Ravenswood Metra to make a pit stop before I walk the last two blocks home? Can I stash enough extra supplies in every bag so that I am never without pads and tampons and extra underwear? Fibroids are a bitch. They are also benign growths on the uterus. Mine grew on the outside of my uterus like mushrooms and inside the walls of the uterus. When they were finally diagnosed by my rheumatologist, who is not supposed to be diagnosing things in your uterus. They're joint doctors. Uterus is not a joint, you guys. When they were finally diagnosed, these gremlins combined to be the size of a 5-month pregnancy. Yeah, right? They had pushed on my spine and pushed on my bladder, so my legs were starting to go numb, and I was always mentally mapping bathroom locations. And my period was wild. It had gone from like a dreamy 3-day flow every 28 days with the moon period to something that was a cross between Raging Rivers water park and like a slaughterhouse, but less predictable than either. Yeah. I was 40 and I had fibroids. I needed surgery. So there are a few options. Most of the options are temporary solutions that would get the fibroids out of my body and preserve fertility. But fibroids come back, and there is no predicting how long they'll take to return. I was 40, and I had fibroids. If I didn't pick the permanent solution, which is a hysterectomy, I would probably need another surgery in the future. More care was inevitable if I kept my uterus and just like trimmed back the fibroids. You can laugh. Fibroids are ridiculous. I was 40 and I had fibroids, and Paul Ryan was trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. First on his list was getting rid of protection for people with pre-existing conditions. Protections that include basically every person on the fucking country, but people who have survived cancer, have diabetes, have ever been pregnant, had a back injury that you got physical therapy for, have a diagnosed mental illness. Protection for people with pre-existing conditions has kept millions in this country out of bankruptcy for personal medical debt. Protections for people with pre-existing conditions meant that I could choose a temporary solution and see what happens. But I didn't trust Paul Ryan to stop fucking with the Affordable Care Act. And I didn't want to risk having to pay cash in the future for a hysterectomy. So I was 40 and I had fibroids and I chose infertility. I chose a hysterectomy because if my uterus was gone, then I couldn't have a pre-existing condition of fibroids in the future. The ruling party that preaches anti-choice vitriol and calls itself pro-life made me choose infertility because I couldn't trust them to leave the law alone. So I got my hysterectomy, and I am very happy with my decision. And I will talk to anyone who wants to talk through it. I cut my ovaries, I got rid of my fallopian tubes and my uterus and my cervix. Physically, I feel better day to day than I have in years. I still have phantom periods because I cut my ovaries. So that means that once a month, like last night, I find myself crying on the couch with a bag of Doritos and a pint of ice cream, but I never get the relief of my period starting. Yeah. I'm angry. I am angry that Paul Ryan and the Republican regime made me choose infertility over the risk of future bankruptcy. The only way to help other women get to make choices that are best for their body is to call our elected officials, protest the changes, and vote. Guess what? Tuesday is Election Day, or as I like to call it, Pre-Existing Condition Protection Day. You can cheer for that. If saving the Affordable Care Act doesn't do it for you because you're a weirdo, here are some alternative titles for Tuesday. Defend the 14th Amendment Day. Dismantle Systemic Racism Day. All Politics Are Personal Day. The Second Amendment isn't sacred day. All politics are local day. Kids should be safe at school day. Don't murder me in my synagogue day. Gerrymandering is bullshit day. Schools should be funded equitably day. Water should be lead free day. No cop academy day. Medicare for all day. Fund and repair public transportation day. Like, take whatever you need for Tuesday and vote. It's our second election without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act, which gave all women the right to vote in 1965. It's our second election without the protection of the VRA. So if you are able, if you are not being stopped from voting, fucking go out there and vote early, because there are 51 locations. If you don't vote, I am gonna send you photographs of my uterus on the table after it was removed from my body. So, or you could vote. Thank you.
Okay, just speaking as someone who's actually seen the photographs of Leah's uterus, you really do not want to see them. Or maybe you do, because you yourself are probably going to get them removed, or you want to just look at them anyway, but it's pretty gnarly. The body is incredible, but also gross. Okay.
Yes. So that is our show. Please join us in thanking today's readers. We got Hope Rehack,
Chloe Riley,
woo! Samantha Abernathy,
and Leah Jones.
Yeah!
We would also like to thank the Gallery Cabaret and you, the audience, for being here. You can find out more you can find out more about the show at miss-spoken.com.
And you can also listen to past shows on the Misspoken podcast. Just search for Misspoken on Stitcher or iTunes. Misspoken will be back at the Gallery Cabaret on Wednesday, November 28th. And the theme of that show is
Family Feud.
Woo! Now, this is usually the point where we'd say goodnight and, like, you know, please come up and, like, you know, put more money in the Morton salt can if you haven't already. But we'd also like to, you know, take some of your time for a brief PSA.
Yes.
About voting.
Vote.
So you should vote, yes. And you may, I don't know how you could possibly feel disillusioned after what we've heard tonight. But if you are, I mean, that's fair. You should vote anyway, because this is really not the time to do nothing, okay?
Yeah, so you can check to see if you're registered to vote online by going to www.vote.org. If you are not registered, that's totally okay, because you can register to vote in person up until November 6th.
Yeah.
And if you don't know who the judges are, educate yourself at voteforjudges.org. And you're looking at two people who literally had to spend decades of their lives trying to become citizens so they could freaking vote. That's my guilt trip for you tonight.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so if you're thinking about not doing it, just think of our immigrant faces staring at you in judgment. We'll be posting links to all of this information on our Facebook page, and if you have any questions, let us know or talk to Sam or Leah, apparently.
Yeah, probably should.
Yeah, and I think that's it, so thank you and good night.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening. Visit miss-spoken.com for the occasional update, information on our next show, and how to get involved.